Welcome to The Grand Conversation, the Machon Siach podcast. Machon Siach at SAR High School, honoring the memory of Belda Kaufman Lindemaum Zichrona Levracha, is the research arm of SAR High School, where faculty bridge theory and practice on matters of Jewish education, curriculum, and culture. I'm your host, Shmuel Hain, Rosh Beit Midrash at SAR High School. Our producer is Avi Bloom, and our engineer is Greg Schmidt. This episode of The Grand Conversation highlights the vision behind the work Machon Siach is doing to help students at SAR High School develop connections and convene meaningful and sometimes challenging discussions with high school students from schools across the Bronx. I am so thrilled to welcome two individuals, David Sable and Aaron Mitchell, who, with Rabbi Hartstark, partnered together to conceptualize the vision for this project. David is a longtime member of the SAR and Riverdale communities and a true leader in the global marketing community. Aaron is a prominent entrepreneur, business leader, and HR professional who has been a historic change agent recognized for his pioneering work with Netflix and Black-owned banks. David and Aaron are joined today by Rabbi Tuli Hartstark, my boss, founding principal of SAR High School, and the dean of Machon Siach. David, Aaron, and Tuli, welcome to The Grand Conversation.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for having us.
All right, I'm going to begin with you, David. I've seen you meeting with Rabbi Hartstark in his office multiple times over the past year, and I've been curious about what it is that you guys have been discussing. Can you share with us some of the origins of this project, what Shine a Light is and what the Confidence Project is, sure. Which I think were the building blocks for the work that Machon Siach and SAR High School are doing in this area?
Sure, for sure. But before that, I just want to say it's an honor to be here. And I'm honored to be on with Aaron and Rabbi Hartstark and you. And, you know, the first time I heard the words, the Grand Conversation, was I don't know how many years before even the first shovel went into the ground, but it was in our living room. And I was given a vision of SAR that to this day still blows my mind. And so I thank you for that, Rabbi Hartstark. And you inspired me that day all those years ago. And I'm proud that I have two grandsons in the school now who are part of it. And amazing. So thank you.
Always grateful for your support, David.
Well, thank you. So let me start by talking about, to just take a minute about Shine a Light, where this came from, and then get into the specifics. So a number of years ago, it became evident to a group of private Jewish foundations led by the Kirsch Foundation that the communal fight against anti-Semitism was failing. And by that, I mean that there were any number of Jewish organizations that were involved in the fight, probably more every week, every day, I don't know. There was always something new. Everybody declared victory in the sense that they said they had the answer, until it came time to raise money for the next year, when they said, well, actually, we didn't get there and we need more money. And it was completely disassociated with anything. Each group kind of did their own thing. There was nothing that brought it together. There was no central messaging. There was no real research at the center of it that would drive the kind of marketing program that we would do if we were selling soap or toothpaste. And these groups got together, led by Kirsch, as I said, and they said, all right, we want to do a project. They approached me and my partners. I was doing something private at the time. And they said, would you people be interested in leading it? And we talked with them about it, what it would mean, what it would be. In their briefing paper, they used the words, really what they wanted to do was shine a light on anti-Semitism. And we said, well, that's the name. Let's just call it Shine a Light. It's like, it's perfect. It's exactly what we want to do. And I think that the departure of the program was twofold. And I think that's what made it different from anything else. Just on the organizational side, there were pillars of activity. So it wasn't just that there was a marketing program. There was a group that went after the various DEI programs across corporate America to make sure that they actually had the right materials, that they had access to the kind of training that they needed. A lot of discussion with those groups. Aaron was absolutely instrumental in helping us understand them. And what became clear when we had open conversation was that everybody wanted something. They just didn't have the right materials. And I think that was good. There was a whole group that was about advocacy. And there was a tremendous amount of advocacy in Washington at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level all across the country. And then, of course, there was the marketing program and others. I think that the messaging departure was that, based on research that we had done, we felt that one of the big problems of all of these programs was their focus on anti-Semites. So somebody said something that we took as being anti-Semitic, and everybody got together yelling and screaming and complaining and whatever, and then somebody maybe would reach out or maybe not. But it was always about an individual or a group. So you called out the anti-Semite. The problem was that we found, when you actually went back and looked at it, not everybody called out was an anti-Semite. We probably alienated a whole bunch of people who actually were allies. But anybody that said anything that we felt, and I say we in the collective Jewish communal sense, felt was treading on thin ice, we called an anti-Semite. So this became shine a light on anti-Semitism. And the point of it was that when you really shine a light on anti-Semitism, it's shining a light on hate. And hate leads to more hate. And so again, there's a ton of research on this, that where in a community you start with an anti-Semitic issue, it very quickly escalates elsewhere. And so it was very successful. Aaron joined us in this program. Aaron and I met, we were on a board together. He blew my mind with his understanding of the issues of interracial, interreligious, and he became a tremendous help for us. So as we moved along, the second piece of this became the issues that were happening on campus. Now, interesting enough, Shine a Light stayed away from campus issues because it was very complex. There were so many groups working on campus. It was hard to break through any of the messaging. Everybody had their own view. Everybody had their own problem. And it seemed to us that part of the issue was that the one thing they all had in common was teaching Jewish pride. And so what was Jewish pride? Jewish pride was, do you know that we have more Nobel Prize winners than anyone else? Do you know that Israel is the biggest democracy in the Mideast and has the most moral army in the world? There were things that were related, believe them or not, it was more quote unquote fact-based. And our kids would crumble in 10 seconds when hit with, yeah, but I'll just use a contemporary example. Yeah, but you're killing thousands of people in Gaza. And so Jewish pride wasn't the issue. They were proud Jews. By the way, there are proud Jews who are sitting in those encampments on campus today. And we might not like them. We might think that they're whatever they might be, but to themselves, they're proud Jews. They're identifying, they're self-identifying as Jews. So we said, you know what the real issue is? We need Jewish confidence. We need to teach them to be confident in who they are, confident in what their Judaism teaches them, the ethical and moral attributes that are core to who we are. And then if you teach that, it gives you much more ammunition when you go and you speak to people who you can say, you know what? I agree with some of what you're saying. I'm listening to you. I hear you. And it opens up a space that we felt would be different. So of course, as we thought about who we could go to, there was only one person in the world that I knew would understand what we were trying to do and where this was. And and one place in all that was Rabbi Hochstock in SAR. And we went, we had a few sessions where we talked it out. And it was interesting, just the discussions amongst ourselves and his staff were pretty fascinating. And then we brought Aaron in to help, and I'll let them tell the rest of the story.
Thank you so much, David. That's great in terms of the background. And now I understand why those meetings were as animated and engaging from through the glass windows as they were. Aaron, I want to...
By the way, I also got like a Sting t-shirt out of it. So that was like a big deal too.
Worth the trip.
The swag was always worth it. Aaron, I guess my question to you is, what inspired you to get involved in these initiatives? A business leader from LA with your decorated career in HR, that's a long way from a yeshiva high school in the Bronx. So how did you get involved, and what was kind of your motivation for being involved?
So I guess the thing about my background that isn't obvious is that I've always been a creative person pretending to be an HR person, as opposed to like this HR person that has creativity on the side. I went to a performing arts high school, and you know, the thing that David mentions about just sort of this understanding, I'd say it's less of an understanding and more of a curiosity, right? Like, I'm super curious about people. I'm curious about finding, you know, the moral high ground, the truth in this sort of sea of disagreement. I'm a middle child, and so I'm used to being in the middle of a whole lot of dissenting opinions. And so when I left Netflix in September 2022, that's when David approached me about Shine a Light. And I was actually, to be honest, terrified, right? I had worked at Netflix when Netflix purchased the Roald Dahl Story Company. And that triggered a lot of internal discussion around anti-Semitism and the environment we were trying to cultivate. And I felt super duper ill-equipped to engage in these discussions. But part of my job was trying to create safe space for discussions to take place, for people to express their discomfort, their understandings. And that part, you know, sort of sitting in this discomfort was the thing that I think helped us get through this rather difficult situation. So when David said, "Hey, want to bring you on to Shine a Light," I'm like, I have no real expertise in anti-Semitism, and I'm actually scared of this. And I told him these things, and he's like, "That's why I want you in this space, right? One, you listen, you're curious, and two, you have an understanding of people to help find the sort of truth in these scenarios." And so, somewhat reluctantly, I said yes. And the reluctance was obviously what kept me from making missteps, which kept me from making assumptions and sort of opening my mind, listening, learning. And so by the time the opportunity with SAR came around, I had been doing this work with Shine a Light for over a year, and nothing had gone terribly wrong. I had learned a great amount about the sort of discomfort people were trying to navigate. And honestly, like, just this feeling of terror that was starting to emerge. And having lived with a version of that in some of the work that I had done with Black Banks in the sort of wake of George Floyd, I wanted to be a part of the solution, right? And so, no, I haven't worked in high schools before, but given the fact that I've sort of built my life and my work around helping people and organizations redefine prosperity, helping to sort of reduce human suffering, this was an easier yes. And it played to just like my natural curiosity. I wanted to learn about how much of the stuff I was doing in corporate spaces was applicable to a high school, right? Like, I think I told Rabbi Hartstark when we first talked about this, I'm like, I'm a little nervous about this. I'm scared I'm going to say something wrong. I don't know I don't even know how to say happy holiday on certain holidays. And I think I expressed that right around one of the holidays. And his response was, "The fact that you ask is an indication that this is going to be useful, because, you know, not coming in with assumptions, but coming in with curiosity, we need to do more of this and we need to cultivate this." And so I think it was sort of the combination of all those things, but also to just dispel this myth that I'm an HR person or a DEI person. I am neither of those things. I like to just put it on record that I'm a creative person who wants to be a part of this positive evolution of humanity. And I want to be in any space that allows me to do that.
Aaron, I just I remember that day with the holiday. I just wanted to point to that because for those of you listening out there, it was right before Rosh Hashanah. And kind of the sensitivity is it's safe to kind of say happy holidays. But I think that, Aaron, you had an intuition that I'm not sure if this is a happy day or exactly what kind of day is this. And I want to make sure I say it right. And what was moving about that, you mentioned the word curiosity before, and it really conveyed a curiosity, and it also made it safe. Whatever your concern about saying the wrong thing, can certainly say that I have a concern, and I think that our team and our faculty, our kids less so, but also have that concern. We, you know, what's the right thing to say? And making it okay to ask just from a place of curiosity. It's like, I mean, why would I know what the right thing is to say before Rosh Hashanah? So what is it? So it was personally meaningful, and also I learned from that kind of exchange about what's possible, how to talk to each other.
So let's pick up the story from when David and Aaron come to meet with you, Tully, and present their ideas or their vision, what the projects that they're working on. How did this then get translated into actual programs at SAR High School? What are you doing as part of this project? And maybe talk a little bit about whether you had some hesitations or challenges to launch this project.
What I think is so, what I'm always very taken by is that each of us has kind of a separate story and journey that had brought us together around this. I think that for us, at SAR, I think that below the surface, for a long time, we've felt that we're a school in the Bronx. We don't really have connections, relationships with other schools in the Bronx. We've got so much to do to take care of kind of our own business. And we know that it would be an important thing to do. But circumstances were such, this is already last year, and it was on the heels of the stories with Ye, with Kanye, and Kyrie Irving. And the school was figuring out how to talk about that and respond to it. And one of our basketball coach, Rafi Halpert, was in touch with the coach of one of the schools in the Bronx, the Fannie Lou Hamer Freedom School. And they decided together that it would be great. This is Coach Skelton there. And the thought was that we should get our kids together to play ball and have pizza. And that was a wonderful event. But a couple of things then transpired over the course of those months from different avenues. We had a school called Compsci High, a different school in the Bronx. It's a really very special place. Great commitments to carry their students through high school and then even through college to support them in whatever ways they need. And they came with a question, some technical question to Mr. Courtney in our college counseling department. But that avenue, somehow those two, when we had two openings, we started to think about these together. And then shortly, a couple of months after that, Congressman Torres had spoken to the Rabbi Krauss at SAR Academy, and then we together had spoken to the congressman's office about a third school, the theater and arts production school in the Bronx. All those three paths opened before I had the first conversation with David. And David started to talk about this confidence idea. We were going back and forth. And then at some point, all of those pieces just came together. It's like this, the idea of being able to have our kids feel like there's a tremendous opportunity here to open paths of communication and learning. And I, again, there's a lot to say about how that came to be, but kind of on that meta level, I love the way that kind of three different people in different places coming from different angles. There's just a convergence of interests and curiosities and talents and expertises that just result in something new. And that's been fun to watch and be a part of.
Can you fill in another piece, Rabbi Hardstark, about what exactly you want to do with these schools, and what's sure. the goal of connecting with these schools?
Yeah, we would like. I actually am. It's on two levels. I think that the idea of having I'll say cross cultural conversation, meaning our kids are in the respective schools are growing up in very different worlds. That's true. Culturally, socioeconomically, in terms of lots of factors. And I think that what's true for students is true for faculty as well. I'm a really big believer that it's very often you talk about things that should happen in schools. It's for the kids, which obviously ultimately it is for the kids. But I think that in a circumstance like this, and this is not so easy to achieve, but to be able to have teachers also talking to each other about what it means to teach kids, what it means for the teachers to talk across cultures, all of that is really important. So what's the shape that it's been taking is we are setting up, we've taken cohorts of students, I'll say approximately, not to get too much into the weeds, about 15 students of ours with a similar amount from the other schools. That's three cohorts. So it's a meaningful group of students, each involved in their own projects. And what's also been interesting is they're all different in terms of the medium through which they're communicating. As I said, the relationship with Fannie Lou Hamer started through sports. Comp Sci High actually started through a discussion of first college, but then it quickly became around anti-Semitism and racism. And they've done lots of activities together. They've met I think the goal is about five or six times over the course of the year, the students. And they've sat and talked about lots of things and also done some communal work together. But the TAPCO project through Congressman Torres, together with Rabbi Krass and the Academy, they're working together on a theater production. We have kind of a small black box-like theater space here, and students during a lunch every 6 weeks or so put on a performance. Our last performance of the year is going to be here in school coming up. It's going to be students from TAPCO and students from SAR. And together they're going to be putting on the results of the work that they've been doing together. So three, different schools, but also through different media. And for us, all parts of that are learning experiences as we hopefully continue this work next year.
That's really remarkable to hear. I work in the school, and I'm just aware when my students are not in class because they're participating in one of these cohorts, but hadn't really had the full picture of the different pieces here. Aaron, I want to ask you what you have learned from this experience and from interacting with Tully and with David and with SAR High School. What are some of the things that your curiosity has led you to observe about the ways in which we can build bridges that you might not have thought were possible before?
I think the thing that sort of jumps out immediately, and we've had a lot of these discussions, is just there's this need to cultivate our ability to sit in discomfort. And I think as separate communities, we can often sit in that discomfort together, but not always as effectively with others. And sometimes we don't know what it is that's going to trigger that discomfort. And in some of these discussions, one of the things that I've done with SAR is dinner discussions where we bring together teachers from the different schools. And in some cases, I think the learning was that the teachers were more uncomfortable in these discussions and concerns about saying the wrong thing than the students that they're creating these spaces for, right? Which represented an opportunity for skill building, represented an opportunity for cultivation, but it also represented an opportunity for like understanding, like, what is it? And if you can't name it, how do we get to the point where we can name it? Because if we can't name it, we can't focus and build that skill. We can't build that resilience. And we need to build that resilience in order to build the community, because the only way we sort of see our way through is with this understanding that we have a mutuality. And I think people start thinking that, but then the expectation is of what somebody else can do to be better equipped as opposed to what they can do themselves. And seeing people sort of make that realization in real time, you know, one was uncomfortable. And I was also like, I'm like terrified in these discussions. And I tell, you know, David didn't tell you this all the time. I'm like, I'm eventually going to say like the wrong thing. And I hope that I've laid enough groundwork that it doesn't cause damage. It doesn't cause harm. But also, if it does, that there's a path toward reconciliation, because if we can't figure that piece out, then we're doomed to continue, you know, sort of remain separate. And so much of that learning has happened in real time. And it's been exciting to be a part of it, because even though there's been discomfort, even though there's been some things and cases where the wrong things have been said, there hasn't been anybody who said, I don't want to do this. There's, if anything, it's been, I want to do this and I want to be better equipped. I want to do this and I want to understand better what it is I can bring into the conversation. And again, like I've had these dinners with Tully, I've had these dinners with David. I think I've learned different things in all of them, but there's just this deep desire to like figure out how to sit in that discomfort more and more. And that's encouraging.
So can I just add to that? See, I think, Robert, part of the issue is that in a lot of the work that's been done previously, prior to our thinking about how we might take this a different direction, everything ended up being about kumbaya. So if you couldn't hold hands from the beginning and then walk out holding hands and singing, like there was no point to it. And so people would get together and you wouldn't have that kumbaya. It might have not been uncomfortable, but they might not have. And everybody's, oh, it's a failure. See, you can't do this. I think what I learned from Aaron early on was this notion of discomfort. So I've been in the sessions, we've done any number with serious corporate types, people of, you know, fairly senior in their organizations, involved in all kinds of different things. And Aaron's opening line to them is, look, you're going to be uncomfortable. This is not a safe space. You're going to be uncomfortable. And if you can't, if you're not able to, probably you want to leave. And I can tell you, nobody's ever walked out. Nobody's ever left at that moment. Nobody's ever left at the end. And every discussion was uncomfortable. I mean, I can honestly tell you that I did not sit in one of these corporate discussions where there wasn't a degree of discomfort, and you have to make a decision. So while you're sitting there, then, which is the whole point, like, what do you say when somebody says something that makes you uncomfortable? Do you attack them? Do you immediately say, depending on who you are, you're a racist, you're an anti-Semite, you're Islamophobic, whatever it may be? Or do you just try to process it and put yourself in their shoes? What would you say? What would you think? What would you do? I think one of the things that, one of the terms that I learned from Aaron that I love is the oppression Olympics. So, you know, you get into these, it's very often you get into these situations and you literally get into an oppression Olympics. It's like, okay, we were slaves. Yeah, that's nothing. You were slaves for 200 years. We were slaves for 400 years in Egypt. Yeah, well, we were, and everybody tries to trump the other one with who had more oppression. And that's a nowhere's discussion. People think they're building empathy because you suffered, I suffered, they suffered, we all suffered, but that does nothing. It's irrelevant to the conversation. And so you got to put that aside and get to the point, which is, how do I create pathways for discussion that in fact might make me uncomfortable? In fact, I might never agree with you on 100%. But I got to tell you, 80-20, 70-30 is pretty good. And if we can get to that place, we will change the world.
I want to just ask about that changing the world piece, because one of the things that I'm curious about is what is the goal, the ultimate goal here? Is this a corporate, changing the face of corporate America when it comes to questions of anti-Semitism and racism? Is it working with some high schools? the Shine a Light on Anti-Semitism Project, the Jewish Confidence Project. What ultimately do you hope to achieve with these very ambitious concepts, and how are you measuring some success in these areas?
So I would say that really my goal is looking at the younger generation and to make sure that by the time they're where we are, they don't have to have these conversations, because they instinctively know, and we have leaders who know how to drive those conversations. I want to, at the corporate level, it's kind of the same thing. Why do I need a safe space? Why is what's so bad in our discussions that I need to run into a safe space because I'm worried that somebody's going to say something to me? And why can't I have empathy for the other person? Why can't I understand? Why can't I put myself in their shoes and understand that, in fact, if I'm a Palestinian, for example, just to give you contemporary issues, some that I deal with on a daily basis, if I'm a Palestinian working in a company and I'm one, but there's lots of Jewish people around and they're all going off on, you know, Palestinian statehood or whatever, every Palestinian is a terrorist. And I'm sitting here saying, from the river to the sea, whatever it is, doesn't make a difference. We had an issue, right? Because I'm not listening to you. You're not listening to me. So how do we create that so I can have true understanding? It's not just empathy. Put myself in their place. What would I do? And I have to tell you, I think that is the hardest conversation to have, because I don't know about you, but every time I think about it, right? Every time I think about what would I do if I was in their shoes, where would I be? And sometimes it's frightening. Because if you think about our own pathway to statehood, and you think about, again, I don't mean to be political here, so it's not a political statement, but if you think about the Irgun or Begin or whatever, and then you put yourself in there, what would we have done? Where would we be? Think that we're the British, and that, like, it changes the way you look at it. And I'm not interested that they're not doing that yet. I want to help them get to a place where they can, but the only way I can is if we open ourselves up for it. I'll just say that I learned this from Rabbi Melchior many years ago. You know, Rabbi Melchior, who was once, you know, Chaver Knesset, he was from the Meimad party, which my late father-in-law was one of the founders of, and Rav Amital. He said he was speaking at the UJA, you know, the big convening, right? And he said, Oseh Shalom Bimromav, you know, we walk back three steps. Why do we walk back three steps? Because you can't make peace unless you open up your space. If you want to be the peacemaker, you can't say no. That's not an operative word. You can't put up the barriers. You have to take the risk. You've got to open up. You got to move back. And I hope that answers your question, because that's where I want to be. I want to be moving back, opening up that space, and creating that place where we can all be uncomfortable, but be uncomfortable moving ahead, moving humanity ahead, not coming to an impasse.
Yeah, Aaron, what... I see you doing nodding and agreeing. I'm curious what you think in terms of your own communities that you have been involved with your whole life, what you see as the goals of these projects.
Yeah, I'd say very much similar to David in that, like, I think it's hard to put a metric around, right? Like, we should see X percentage or Y percentage of such and such, right? I would hope you'd see that in just the sort of incidents that are being tracked that are actually measurable, that you'd see a reduction in these things. But I think it's something that you feel. It's knowing that, like, you ask somebody to do something that would have naturally made them uncomfortable and recoil, And there's just more willingness to engage in the uncomfortable. There's more willingness to go where you didn't think you were invited, because that I'm not invited mentality is not as present as it was once was, right? I've made it a point in my life to go toward the things that make me uncomfortable. It's my entire sort of lived experience is being in spaces that when I first got there, I'm like, I don't think I should be here, and over time feeling more and more comfortable. And the moment that I feel and experience comfort is when I feel the need to try something new and go somewhere else. I think that we've made progress with this work when more and more people are opting into those environments, right? And they're opting into those environments, not because they've achieved that kumbaya that David was talking about, but because they feel like discomfort is not a sign of something bad, but a sign of some progress, a sign of, you know, like as a creative person, for instance, I'm a jazz musician by background. And Miles Davis had this thing where he would say, the minute you're comfortable on stage, you're doing it wrong. Because if you're not exploring, if you're not pushing the boundaries, then you're not giving this music what it deserves. And he would fire musicians that would play the things that they knew how to play. And I think that that is representative of the space that we're trying to create. And it feels, you know, highbrow, but I think it's really easy to like actually experience that, right? When you see more natural, larger communities of people who yesterday and a week and a month and a year ago would not have crossed paths, but they're doing so and they're getting it wrong and they're not, you know, vilifying one another and sort of canceling one another because they got it wrong, but they're using it as an opportunity to continue to build the relationship. That's where I want this thing, and I see an opportunity for this thing to get. But it's hard to say, like, and it would be measured as such. So when I hear the term metric, that's one of the things that comes up a lot in corporate spaces. It's like, well, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And for this one, I'm like, you can measure it with the heart. You can measure it with your body. You may not be able to measure it on paper, but I know we'll all know when we get there, because I even feel it with David and with Rabbi Hartstark, where we started and the level of disagreement we can engage in now more comfortably. I love being in this place. And I feel like there's so much opportunity when you can do that versus I'm not going to say that thing because I'm going to get it wrong, and I'm not going to get invited back to the party.
Tully, I want you to reflect on what you just heard.
Yeah, there's a lot there. That was great. I actually, we were talking about metrics. It made me think about, I wanted to share two stories. And I think that they serve as metrics. They might not be quantitative, but they are qualitative. And that also counts, I think, for something important. And especially because the first one is a story from our first dinner with teachers that Aaron led, the Kamsai High teachers and SAR team got together and were talking about discomfort. And it was a multi-course meal. So after the first and before the second course, we tried to dive in a little bit. And I think that question was put on the table. It's like, well, what about this discomfort? It's like, well, I don't know if the kids are going to be uncomfortable. What's the... And I hope Adina won't mind my saying that loud. She's like, well, I'll tell you.
Adina Schulzen.
At some point, we're going to talk about intermarriage. That's going to be really uncomfortable. We're talking about what our belief that we should marry our own. And one of the teachers from Kamsai High said, my parents tell me that we should marry our own also. And it was such a powerful moment because it was the thing that you just didn't want to, you're afraid to say out loud. And I by no means suggest that that always works out that way, but you don't know what you're going to find. That's exactly, I think, the point. And at that moment, it was, okay, it actually made me reflect on the use of the word confidence. When David first suggested it, I was kind of pondering about how much that rolls off the tongue. The one thing that I think is really important about it is that we sometimes think about it in a very binary way. Like our community has to be insular in order to maintain our integrity. And if we kind of open ourselves up, then it just is a slippery slope, and who knows where it's going to land. And the idea of the confidence part is, I think that what that word carries is, if you talk directly to our kids, it's, yeah, you need to have the confidence to be who you are while you're talking to somebody else. And that's going to entail, as it did at these meetings, kids saying, well, let me explain to you what we're doing when we get up and wash our hands before we eat, or what these, you know, blessings are. And, you know, when we said Birkat HaMazon the first time there, I think that the students from the other school were, it was over and they didn't realize that it started because they were waiting for kind of a out loud chant. And it's like, well, that's not how it happens. People just kind of say it by themselves. Like, those tiny things are really important forms of communication. But the other story that I wanted to say is just from this morning at SAR Academy, Rabbi Krauss hosted a press conference for Congressman Torres and Michal Kotler-Wunsch, the Israel's envoy for anti-Semitism, was here. And some of our students went over. The press conference happened at SAR Academy. And our staff actually called Andrew, who's one of the staff members of Comp Sci High, said, this is happening. And he said, we'd like to bring some of our kids. So just that moment, and as you have students from across the Bronx, this would not have happened. And our kids and their kids and the staff member get together around at this moment in support of you know, what's good and right and dignified and against anti-Semitism. That happened because of this kind of approach.
That's great. I guess I'm inspired by Aaron to lean into the discomfort with this last question. And that is, with what's been going on since October 7th, the war in Gaza, the protests on campus, how has that impacted your thinking about this work? Are you discouraged? How has that played out even amongst the high school kids? Have we tried to engage with discussions about that? Because there are a lot of individuals who are framing the issue in Gaza as very, very much related to an oppressor and the oppressed, and to, you know, comparing it to race relations in America. And I can imagine that's a really untouchable, uncomfortable topic at the moment. David and Aaron, we'll hear from you first if you have some thoughts.
Aaron, you want to go first?
Absolutely. I'd say for me, honestly, because of my, I don't know, I get a dopamine burst from leaning into discomfort. So as you can imagine, like, the more charged, the more divisive, the more necessary it feels. And, you know, I think when David reached out to me originally on Shine a Light, I think it was an anticipation that this moment was around the corner at some point. And we need to do as much as we can to really equip people to be in these spaces, because there's going to come a time where it's going to be very hard to navigate that thing clearly. And I think, if anything, October 7th and the war and the protest have made, like, building these skills and creating these spaces even more necessary. And even, you know, it's like, how do we do this more quickly? How do we do this? You know, this has created a sense of urgency in some ways that may have made people a little bit more laxed. But it also, I think, makes the lack of one knowledge and the lack of resilience even more clear in the communities that need to come together. And so I think that makes the skill building pieces in some ways easier. Now, that being said, I find the moment that we're in to be terrifying, right? Because I think that there's a normalization of certain things and people don't necessarily see just how systemically anti-Semitic things can be. And so it's hard to tease that out when people believe that they are right. But I think it also just helps to know, you know, that we're sort of in this moment of categorical thinking on steroids, and we have an answer. We have a solution, we have an antidote. And so there's a level of excitement about being able to create these spaces, especially with folks that are in, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, because I feel like our future relies on the students that are in these spaces to create a better world. And so the thing that we're trying to do, I think, scales because the people that we are equipping are actually going to be able to change the world. I'm not saying that the adults are a lost cause, but I am saying that we get a lot of leverage doing this work with students, because they're going to go out and they're going to shape the world. They're going to shape the campuses. And it's even more important for them now because of everything that's going on in the world.
David.
So yes to everything Aaron said. I'll just say that I think what to me is the core of discomfort, and it's the discomfort that I want to live in and that I push, is that we've created a binary issue here. And there is nothing worse than in trying to solve these issues than being binary. And by that, I mean, you know, on October 7th, it was a very clear issue. It was these Hamas terrorists who are a threat to the entire world, who have killed Americans, who they and their cohorts, like their lookalikes, are killing young blacks in Africa. They've killed Muslims in all across the Mideast, Afghanistan, Iran. Makes no, these are the people. And we turned it into a binary, which was stand with Israel against Palestinians. And it's become it's a tough conversation, and it's a very uncomfortable place to be. And you talk to people in our community, and they have a hard time saying, I feel terrible for every child who was killed, or every child who died, or every child who's starving in Gaza, because somehow that makes you complicit with terrorism.
Every Shabbos before I go to shul, my wife says to me, I'm a rabbi of a congregation, Shmuel, people don't want to hear about Gazan civilians, because she knows that I want to say something at some point about innocent civilians. And she's worried for me that if I give voice to that in too prominent a way, that that will brand me.
Rabbi, you just proved my point.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, right? This, why shouldn't we? Right? We believe we're the light unto the nation. We believe that we have a higher ethical purpose. So we're not saying we support terrorism. We're not saying don't bring the hostage. Obviously, that's what we want. Obviously. But why can't we have empathy? Why is that such an issue? And so I find that to be the most important moment of discomfort. And I hear this from my Muslim friends. I'm on the board of MJAC, which is a Muslim Jewish Action Committee, which is an incredible group of people. And talk about it, discomfort is, the whole thing is about living in discomfort. But in the first call that we had together after October 7th, everybody sort of got a chance to say what was on their minds. It was fascinating that a number of our Muslim cohort, you know, people who are on the board with us, said, why are you, meaning us, the Jews, forcing us into a binary answer? Like, I've been sitting with you for 5 years. I proved I'm an anti-Semite. I take the same discomfort that Rabbi Hain just talked about. I get in my community every once in a while if I go too far, but I've stayed the course. So why are you forcing me to make this binary thing about Israel versus Palestine, two states versus, it's the wrong discussion. And it's not, I'm not being political here. I'm not saying you have to agree or disagree with one or the other, but that's not the discussion that's going to solve the issue. And so we need to be able to go up to those kids on campus and say, you know what? It's true. Too many people are dying, and it hurts me. I don't sleep at night, which is true. And I can introduce you to Israeli generals who I know who are in therapy, because, and one of them told me he'll be in therapy the rest of his life because of some of the decisions he's had to make. Like, we get that. We understand that. And what we need is for you to be open to us and help us navigate this and help us get these hashirah. That's the discomfort. And so I think this is the proving ground for, and the battleground for what we need to come to grips with in order to move forward.
Tully, I want to ask if in a high school setting with parents, if too much discomfort or pushing kids too far, especially on this issue of Israel and Gaza at the moment, that's something that is maybe a little bit too much of a challenge for us.
Yeah, I think that after people should not leave with the wrong impression here in terms of what actually goes down. It is pretty remarkable. For the most part, kids really want to talk to each other. It's, you know, it is, and they don't necessarily want to talk about the things, the ways in which the world is coming apart. Mm. And they spend a lot of time when they're together. Some of the examples before, some of the cross-cultural differences don't have to do with, most of them are not about the world, the things that are tearing the world apart. Most of them are just about ways in which we're raised differently from each other and where does...
How we say grace after meals.
Yeah. What's the origin of your name and what's the origin of your name? And
how to pronounce Shmuel and Tully.
Exactly. Right. Things like that. And so I think that most of the time is like that. But I will also say that at some point you have a conversation like, student came and said, I follow a couple of the kids on Instagram, and there was a student who posted something that was really hurtful. It's like, how am I supposed to manage that? Because should I respond? Should I tackle it? Should I just ignore it? Because, what good is it going to end that? And the student actually talked it through and then sent something to the fellow student in the other school saying, like, this is how I understood what you were writing. And they had it back and forth. They didn't agree, but it was respectful. And I do find myself, the goal is to be prepared for when it gets uncomfortable. It really is not about, okay, guys, we're getting together, let's get uncomfortable. I don't think that's not what kids want, and I don't think that's the best, that's not the way to establish connection. And I think that the relationship, when we look at the end point now, we're coming to an end of a year, all the kids who are in this program now want to do it again. Next year, and there are other kids who want to join. Actually, that's what's going to happen in this program. We're going to broaden it out because that I think is the best sign, and it makes you better equipped to actually then have a more uncomfortable, difficult conversation because it's just not all about that. You're building on something when you're having that conversation.
I agree,
David, Aaron, Tully. This has been an incredible hour of conversation. There's so much more to discuss, and I hope that maybe in future episodes we'll talk to some students and to some faculty about what they've learned. And I really want to just express my thanks to Aaron and to David for thinking of SAR and working with SAR and Machon Siach on this. And I'm really inspired to hear about it, and I'm looking to get more actively involved as an educator at the school and as a parent in the school. It's really wonderful to hear about all this. Kol hakavod, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Grand Conversation. Please be sure to visit our website, www.machonsiach.org, where you can subscribe to our podcast and find all of our work, papers, essays, podcasts on a variety of subjects. Until next time, this has been The Grand Conversation, the Machon Siach Podcast.